From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The evidence is starting to make it look like we are at peak oil now, that we are facing decline in global oil supplies. It's very hard to be absolutely sure. It usually takes a few years before you can say 100%, but that's the way the evidence is looking.
Peak oil fears are based on simplistic mathematical models. The reality is the world has only used about 10% of its oil resource.
Production reach maximum capacity. We'll host a debate on peak oil. Then a series of protests are scheduled across the country over the next 3 days, from the war in Iraq to genocide in Darfur to anti-immigrant legislation. We'll look at why people are taking to the streets. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Human Rights Watch is warning a new Sudanese military offensive is increasing the risks to civilians in Darfur. The group says government forces have stepped up indiscriminate bombings of villages, displacing thousands of people. Meanwhile, the Sudanese government has rejected a U.S.-backed proposal to send more than 15,000 U.N. and NATO peacekeepers to Darfur. In Washington Thursday, Illinois Senator Barack Obama urged international intervention.
There have been times where the international community has been surprised about what is taking place and can excuse itself for inaction by saying we didn't know. This is not one of those circumstances. This is being filmed. It's being documented. People have written about it. It is a slow-rolling genocide. And the notion that we are going to stand by in the face of this is unacceptable. And I think it's unacceptable to the American people, and my hope is it's unacceptable to the international community.
Illinois Senator Barack Obama will have more on Darfur later in the program. In Washington, speculation's increasing. White House aide Karl Rove will be the next person charged in the CIA leak case. On Wednesday, Rove spent more than 3 hours appearing before the grand jury investigating the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. It was Rove's fifth grand jury appearance. MSNBC's reporting, Rove was questioned about his previous failure to disclose he'd spoken about Plame to a reporter for Time magazine. Several analysts said the questioning suggests the grand jury is preparing an indictment on perjury charges. Lawyers in the case expect a decision within the next few weeks. In other news, the CIA is warning former employees not to engage in unapproved conversations with the media. According to the Financial Times, one former official said several retired employees have been threatened with the loss of their pensions. Another former official said CIA head Pertegas has increased polygraph testing on current employees. The official said Goss is trying to, quote, scare everybody. A new congressional report says the cost of the war in Iraq will soon top $320 billion, a figure that will likely more than double by war's end. According to the Congressional Research Service, the ongoing operations in Iraq and Afghanistan stand to cost nearly as much as the Departments of Education, Justice, and Homeland Security combined. As gas prices continue to soar, the world's largest oil company has once again announced record-breaking profits. On Thursday, ExxonMobil reported a quarterly profit of $8.4 billion, the fifth highest quarterly total for any public company in history. In January, Exxon posted profits of close almost $11 billion, which stands as the highest quarterly profit of any company ever. In other news, a coalition of elderly advocacy groups have filed a lawsuit accusing the Bush administration of failing to ensure low-income Americans are properly enrolled in the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. The suit says the Bush administration's alleged negligence has prevented thousands of Medicare recipients from receiving proper care. On Capitol Hill Thursday, Republican Senator Arlen Specter said the Bush administration's continuing to stonewall congressional inquiries into its warrantless domestic spy program. Specter said he's considering a proposal to cut off funding for the National Security Agency until the Bush administration answers questions over the program's legal justification. Specter said, quote, institutionally, the presidency is walking all over Congress. Here in New York, 57 people were arrested Thursday at a protest in support of New York University's Graduate Students Union. Members of the Graduate Student Organizing Committee have been on strike since November over the school's refusal to negotiate a second contract. In other news, 10 states have filed lawsuits with the Environmental Protection Agency over its decision not to regulate carbon dioxide pollution as a contributor to global warming. The states, led by New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer, are asking the government to impose tougher pollution standards on new power plants. In Mexico, lawmakers have passed a declaration of support for Monday's walkout for immigrants' rights in the United States. Mexico's Congress will send a delegation to Los Angeles to take part in the protest. A new report from two watchdog groups says 18 of this country's wealthiest families have been behind a multi-million-dollar lobbying campaign to repeal the federal estate tax. According to Public Citizen and United for a Fair Economy, the families have directly funded campaigns and set up shadow associations to spread misleading information on the benefits of repealing the tax. The groups say a repeal of the estate tax would save the families over $71 billion. The families include those behind the companies Walmart, Campbell's Soup, and Mars Incorporated. Joan Claybrook of Public Citizen called the campaign one of the biggest con jobs in recent history. In other news, the lone survivor of the Sago mine tragedy has provided new details of his colleague's last hours. In a letter to the 12 miners' families, Randall McCloy Jr. said at least four of the air packs did not work, forcing them to share the devices among themselves. McCloy wrote, quote, "As my trapped co-workers lost consciousness one by one, the room grew still and I continued to sit and wait, unable to do much else." And 4 days after he led a march of thousands of supporters to begin a 10-day jail sentence, transit workers union leader Roger Toussaint will be released today, 4 days early. Toussaint was jailed Monday for authorizing last year's strike that shut down New York City's transit system. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the price of oil soars to record highs and oil companies report record profits, today we look at some reasons why this may be occurring. Last Friday, oil prices rose to over $75 a barrel, with consumers paying an average of $2.91 a gallon, 68 cents higher than a year ago. Yesterday, ExxonMobil, the world's largest oil company, reported the fifth highest quarterly profit for any public company in history. It's actually competing with itself. In January, Exxon posted profits of almost $11 billion, which was the highest quarterly profits of any company ever. Exxon now holds the first, second, fourth, and fifth spots of highest quarterly earnings of any company. And Dutch Shell, another oil company, holds the third spot. With the mid-elections looming in November, Congress and President Bush are scrambling over what to do about the public's increasing concern over the rising oil prices and corporate profits. Yesterday, the president and some Republicans called for eliminating the $2 billion in tax breaks that Congress passed as part of the energy bill last August. Some Democrats have called for a repeal of oil and gas tax breaks worth more than $10 billion over the next 5 years. Earlier this week, Bush stated some of his ideas to address the problem. This is the president speaking to the trade group for ethanol producers on Tuesday in Washington, D.C.
We got to be wise about energy policy here in America. We got to make sure that we protect the environment, but we also got to make sure that we find additional supplies of crude oil in order to take the pressure off the price of crude, which takes the pressure off the price of gasoline at the pump. Now, all I've outlined here today are interim strategies, short-term and interim strategy. The truth of the matter is the long-term strategy is to power our automobiles with something other than oil. We owe it to the American people to be aggressive on price gouging now. We owe it to the American people to be promoting alternative ways to drive their cars so as to make us less dependent on foreign sources of oil. We owe it to the American people to be aggressive in the use of technology so we can diversify away from the hydrocarbon society, and that's precisely what we're doing, and I'm glad to stand with you.
Well, this week, a conference is being held in New York City examining an issue that's getting increasing attention. The Peak Oil Conference, sponsored by Local Energy Solutions and the Five Borough Institute, is bringing together experts in energy, agriculture, economics, and geology to address what they say is partly the cause of high oil prices. peak oil occurs when half of all existing oil has been pulled from the ground. Therefore, oil becomes more expensive and the economy goes into recession. Some experts believe we're at peak now, while others disagree. We go now to a debate on the issue. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by Julian Darley, founder and director of the Post-Carbon Institute and Global Public Media. He's also author of High Noon for Natural Gas, The New Energy Crisis, co-author of the forthcoming book Relocalize Now, Getting Ready for Climate Change and the End of Cheap Oil. On the phone from Amherst, Massachusetts, we are joined by Michael Lynch, president of the Strategic Energy and Economic Research. Previously, Michael was director of Asian Energy and Security at the Center for International Studies at MIT. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Julian Darley, let us begin with you. Can you explain the concept of peak oil?
Peak oil is essentially quite a simple idea. It comes about because when you have a reserve of conventional oil, either in a single reservoir or more particularly in a nation, when you get roughly halfway through, as you said, roughly halfway through that reservoir or that nation's stock, if you like, of conventional oil, then you see a decline in that oil. In other words, the production rises over a period of time. That depends partly on how much effort you put in and also to some extent on the geology and the reservoirs themselves. Rises up. When you get roughly halfway through, in fact, the world average is about 53%. There's nothing magical about 50%. When you get roughly halfway through, then because of a mixture of technical, economic, and geological factors and the structures of reservoirs themselves, you go into a decline. There are no exceptions to this for reservoirs. Unless you apply very powerful secondary, so-called secondary and tertiary recovery techniques, which means pushing in water or carbon dioxide and things like that, even so, you can hold some reservoirs at a plateau for a while, and then they go into decline. They still go into decline. One of the dangers is when you do that, your decline is even faster and difficult to predict.
And what makes you think it's happening now?
Well, history has shown, the most dramatic example being that of the U.S., which its own oil production peaked in 1970. History shows that this happens to all nations. Now, when it happened to the U.S., it was able to import yet more oil. It was already an oil importer in 1970. It was able to import yet more oil. Now it imports approximately 60% and rising. So when this happens to a nation, it turns to other oil-producing nations. The trouble is, when it happens to the world, and the world is roughly halfway through its conventional oil, there are no other planets to turn to import from. So then you get this phenomenon of global oil peak. There's no one else to import from, so the decline begins to happen. And it does look as if we're about halfway through the conventional oil reserve of some 2 and a bit trillion barrels. We've used a bit more than a trillion now. And so it's absolutely inevitable that it will happen. There are corroborating data from various other sources which suggest it's happening around about now. Those are some more technical data. We can go into them if you'd like. It's not just the fact that production figures suggest we're about halfway through. There's lots of other corroborating data as well.
Michael Lynch, your response.
Actually, I think the problem here is that Julian and a lot of the people making these arguments are not that familiar with the technical terms in the oil industry. The estimates that there's about 2 trillion barrels of oil resource are actually done by some very simplistic models, which have not always failed, but almost always failed on both a national and a global level. The oil, conventional oil resource base, the oil in place, is about 8 to 10 trillion barrels. And right now, the most estimates are that about 40% of that will be recovered, in other words, about 3.5 trillion. But the amount we'll recover will grow over time. So we're really not even close to halfway through the conventional oil resource base.
Your response?
Most estimates don't say that we've got about that much, and the oil reservoirs don't grow in time. Well, give it a billion years and you might see quite a bit more oil in the ground, but I don't think we have a billion years. So I'm afraid I disagree with both those statements on factual grounds.
Well, actually, I think the problem is that most of the people who write about peak oil have not been reporting the recent estimates done by geologists and firms and so forth. And in fact, although you see many claims that the amount of reservoirs, the oil in the reservoirs don't grow over time, that is, the amount you can recover don't grow over time. There's a huge amount of data and a lot of research that shows this is true, and I've challenged the peak oil theorists on this. And in fact, their own research says that it's true, but they've chosen to ignore those numbers. You really can't find anything other than claims and assertions that they don't grow. If you simply look at the trade press and the engineering articles, you see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of examples of this.
The amount of oil in the ground simply doesn't grow. What happens is the amount of reported oil can grow. But most geologists now accept and have long admitted privately that they know roughly what's in the ground when they make the discoveries, but it's not wise or convenient for integrated oil companies, the large oil companies, to report those early numbers. So they report a much lower amount. They're forced to by the SEC and other reporting regulations, so it makes legal sense for them to report less than they believe to be there. The nice thing about that from their point of view is, let's say you find a billion barrels and you only report half of it, and it's perfectly legal to do so, that means next year when you say don't find very much, you can report a bit more, and then the same thing the next year after that. So it's been very convenient for the oil companies, but it doesn't mean the amount of oil in the ground grows, and this is very, very important. It simply doesn't. What is there from about a billion or so years of geological and plant activity. There were two large charges about 150 million years ago and about 90 million years ago, ironically from two periods of enhanced global warming. There have been several other periods, although those are look like the biggest periods of deposition and creation, production of oil in the ground. That doesn't grow. What makes some difference is new technology, which has been in place for the last 20, 30, 40 years, although there is considerable evidence that even new technology doesn't really increase the recovery factor very much, at least not very much in the last 20 to 30 years. It helps you to get it out more quickly, doesn't increase that recovery factor, which varies between about 25 and 40% normally, can be a bit higher. So what you're looking at is, number one, real oil that we can really get out does not grow, just the reporting of it. And now, as you see from Shell a couple of years ago, they were forced to admit that their reserves were not nearly as big as they said. Very complex issue, it's true, but this is a matter of reporting. And ultimately, it's molecules that people need to put in their cars and to feed the petrochemical industry, not just reports of molecules. And so what you find is that you can, for instance, you can be creative with how much you've got in your bank account, for instance. But there comes a point when you have to be honest about it, because the bank will say to you, you haven't got that much and you can't spend that much. And to some extent, this is what's been going on with global oil companies. It's not that they've been lying. They have been forced to behave like this, but it's been convenient, as I say. And now we're reaching the point where the truth is coming out. These so-called replacement ratios, for instance, ExxonMobil reputedly replaced 117%. Many of the other oil companies haven't done so well of their oil supplies year on year. But in point of fact, when you look at it, they include gas as well as oil in that. More and more it's been gas that's been making up for oil in terms of replacement of reserves. So
let's get Michael Lynch's response to that.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that we're both talking. Neither of us is talking about the oil, the molecules in the ground. We're talking about reported molecules in the ground. And Julian thinks that when he sees the numbers of 2 trillion, that that's the molecules in the ground, not the reported. The estimates, when he talks about the 2 trillion, the people who make those estimates have raised their estimates over time by about 400 or 500 billion barrels. I mean, I've dealt with the people who've done the original research that he's relying on, and, you know, I've pointed out the flaws in their arguments and the fact that they have had to repeatedly revise their estimates and research. It's a claim that is often made by people like Matt Simmons or Colin Campbell that you can't increase the recovery factor much, you're just getting out faster. But if you look, you'll find that they say this over and over again, and they don't give you any real evidence to back it up. When you talk to the industry, and I've debated with Matt in front of the Society of Petroleum Engineers, And you tell them that Matt says this. He doesn't say this to the engineers because they would laugh at him. That's the reaction. I mean, these guys are working all the time to raise the amount that they can get out of the ground.
We're going to go to break, and then when we come back, continue this discussion on peak oil. Then we'll be joined by the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We'll talk to him about the anti-war protests that's taking place this weekend. Also, we'll talk about Tony Snow's, the new press secretary of President Bush, comments about Jesse Jackson. We'll look at the protests around Darfur and around immigration rights, all coming up.
The energy blues.
Oh, energy. Sometimes I think I'm running out of energy. Seems like we use an awful lot for heating and lighting and driving, reading and writing and driving. Energy. You think we'd be saving it up? Energy. Get it by damming up a river. Energy. A woman could make a breeze deliver. But even with milling and damming, our needs are so much more demanding. Energy. We have to use some kind of fuel. Chop, chop, chop. The cavemen use wood to start their fires. Chop, chop, chop. They made all the tools that they required. Chop, chop, chop. Inventors got more and more inspired. And fires got higher and higher. And clearance got wider and wider.
Energy Blues, Schoolhouse Rocks here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're talking to Julian Darley, founder and director of the Post-Carbon Institute and Global Public Media. We are also joined on the phone by Michael Lynch. Michael Lynch is the president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research, previously director of Asian Energy and Security at the Center for International Studies at MIT. Isn't the real issue not so much that oil will run out of oil, but that the price will become increasingly prohibitive to drill it out? And then that raises the issue of the geopolitics of the whole situation.
Geopolitics and price are all very important issues. I think it's also important to stress that at the moment we're not running out. It's more that we're running down. And the running down is key. When you always need more of something and you start to run down in your supply, that's absolutely critical. Running out, actual running out, i.e. no oil left in the ground, that will be a very long way off. But when you're using 85 million barrels a day and you need to increase, that becomes the issue. As to price of getting it out, if you're referring to that, that is undoubtedly increasing. And not only the dollar price, but the energy price of getting oil and indeed other energy materials out of the ground, that's also increasing. So as the years go on, we will see, or we will find, and it'll be difficult to measure, that we will be getting less energy, as it were, for our energy buck. So that will start to have an important effect. You see the difficulties with the amount of money things cost. For instance, the tar sands in Canada, it's hard to get an exact amount of how much that costs. But certainly when you go to polar and Arctic oil and gas, that is going to be really expensive. We're thinking of North Canadian gas and Russian gas. That is going to really start to show up how difficult it is. And I think it shows you how desperate we're getting, that all the easy oil from Saudi Arabia and indeed from the US, all the cheap stuff, is now in decline, or is indeed has disappeared in some cases. And so we really are getting pretty desperate.
Michael Lynch.
Well, I think the real problem here is the geopolitical one, which is, you know, we're always going to be dependent on the Middle East. And the Middle East is politically unstable, as are Venezuela, Nigeria, you know, California. So the notion that the easy oil is gone is one I've been hearing for 30 years. My grandfather drilled oil in West Virginia, and he used a mule rig, and he probably didn't think that was easy compared to what they're doing now. The thing is, technological advances have generally, in the mineral industry, offset the increase in cost that you get from depletion. So that's why, for instance, the price of copper and iron ore and so forth don't tend to rise over the long term, even though we've used them a lot longer than we've used oil.
I want to ask about Iran and China. The whole issue of whether the whole issue of oil is directing U.S. policy toward these countries. Julian.
I think the issue of oil in terms of Iran and China is clearly extremely important. To pick China first, it is a major oil supplier on its own. It produces about 3.5 million barrels a day. But it, unfortunately for itself, it uses over 6.5 million barrels a day, which now makes it a very large oil importer indeed. And what's about to complicate that, as if it hasn't already been enough of an effect, is that China's own oil production is about at peak and about to go into decline. I think it's fairly clear from looking at the evidence that that's going to happen. So China's going to go from a situation where it was importing more than it was than its increasing production was able to deliver, to the situation where its own oil production is going to go into decline, and yet it's still trying to increase its oil imports. So I think we're going to see a considerable increase in China's demand for oil. Then the matter of Iran, I mean, if one just says to oneself, if Iran had no oil, would there be all this interest in Iran? I think it's pretty clear that the answer would be no, there wouldn't be much interest in it. Iran is a very large oil producer and a fairly major oil exporter. It also has heavy oil as well, which is not so easy to deal with, but it exists. So it's quite clear that oil, I think, is a very large factor, not the only factor in Iran, but a very large important one.
Michael Lynch.
Oil is actually very important in terms of foreign policy in this country and many others. Some of that is perception. There's a sense that, you know, we're not going to get the oil unless we do something special. In reality, most countries find that they can just buy the oil they need. You know, the global oil consumption has been rising for about 100 years, and Chinese oil consumption has been rising sharply for about 15 years now. And we actually had two price collapses during that period. So I think, you know, you just have to remember oil is a cyclical commodity, and we're at the up part of the cycle. We do have to worry about countries like China, which get carried away out of fear that they won't get the resource and maybe undertake certain foreign policy moves that we'd rather they didn't in support of that.
Can you explain the concept of Iranian bourse?
Yes, Iran wants to sell oil in euros. It developed an exchange system to do that. It was supposed to come online in March. It didn't. Some people have suggested it didn't because there was a shortage of trained personnel. I don't know exactly why it didn't. It is said that it will still come on stream later on this year. The reason why that might be a worry is to American policymakers at the top is that it is said that if you sell oil in something other than dollars, it will have a very negative effect on the value of the dollar. And it is true that Saddam Hussein began selling oil in euros in November the year 2000. And was it a coincidence that he was invaded later on? I'm not saying that was the only reason, but there is an interesting correlation.
Why does selling it in euros matter?
If you sell it in euros, it means that people will then want to buy euros in order to trade for oil rather than buying dollars. This is what's put forward, and I think it's a very interesting argument. Well, if you then turn away from you don't need to buy so many dollars and you're starting to buy euros, when you reduce the demand for anything, then generally speaking, the price will go down and the value of it will go down. So that's regarded as the big worry. If you start pricing oil in euros, the value of the dollar will go down.
Michael Lynch?
I think he overstates the case somewhat. I know that many people in OPEC have discussed over the last 30, 40 years, every time the dollar weakens, they say we should switch to another currency, and they usually don't do it because the change in the demand for euros or dollars by shifting currencies would not be very large on a global scale. And I don't think it's the sort of thing that people worry about that much in Washington. They watch that, but it's the kind of thing where, you know, you get a lot of coincidental effects and you don't want to overdraw the actual causality there.
Last question, and that is the theory of peak oil connected to oil wars, wars fought for oil. Julian Darley.
I think, unfortunately, there is a connection. And as we go into oil decline, sometime between about now and at the very latest, I think, 2007, 2008, whatever difficulties we've seen in terms of fighting for oil, and some people say we've been fighting for it for nearly 100 years, I think those difficulties are likely to worsen.
Michael Lynch.
Well, I think that what we'll find more likely, you know, oil will remain important in foreign policy because it's a vital commodity. On the other hand, I think the big fear is that we'll have much lower oil prices in the next couple of years, and countries like Venezuela, Nigeria, Iran, maybe even Saudi Arabia will then be threatened with economic and political instability, and this could cause some problems for us.
I think that there will be some problems, and I think there will be instabilities, both geopolitical and economic. And I think we are going to find that we haven't really faced anything like this before. We've not built nations so, and systems, industrial system like the one we've got. We haven't had one like this before. It's so dependent on these flowing resources. They're not really minerals. Oil and gas, upon which we're so dependent, flow. And that's very different from coal and other things that we have to dig up. And, of course, most of our transport depends on oil, well over 90% of it. All that we move around, which is so much of what the economy, the real economy, actually is. So I think we can, unfortunately, look forward to instabilities of a very high sort. And the plea is, let's start planning for that. The market system, which I think is implicated in a lot of this, is very bad at planning. Indeed, it doesn't say it's trying to plan. We must start planning for this. We can see it coming.
And how do you plan? What are the solutions?
Some of the responses we should be looking at are undoubtedly from government. Government must start trying to assess how much energy we use. We must assess what this decline looks like. That's one of the reasons why public awareness and political awareness is so important in this matter. What does this decline look like? How much energy are we using? How could we start reducing our demand? And in reducing our demand, we have to be, I think the grave danger is that unemployment will go up dramatically unless we plan for it. If we plan and understand that we must start using only what's sufficient, not a great surplus, we use enough rather than too much, then if we use planning techniques, and I'm not referring to large-scale command and control techniques, but planning doesn't have to be that, then we may be able to, and we must, try to offset the unemployment and the other breaks in supply chain. We're all, after all, dependent on food. Food comes a very great distance, mainly powered by oil and gas. So these are very, very important planning issues, and governments have tended to throw away the levers of power, the levers of planning. They've given them away to the market. It's going to be very tricky for them to try and claw those levers back, but planning is what we must start doing.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but we'll continue to discuss the issue. Julian Darley, founder and director of Post Carbon Institute and Global Public Media. Also, Michael Lynch, president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research, previously was at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Thank you both very much. As we turn now to what has been happening this week, and leading up to this weekend, mass demonstrations are going to be taking place this weekend. But first, we turn to Jesse Jackson. At the White House on Wednesday, President Bush introduced his new press secretary, former Fox News commentator Tony Snow. Snow is already coming under scrutiny for a series of controversial comments he's made on his radio program. Just last week, he said, quote, "People like Jesse Jackson, who've committed themselves to a view that blacks are constantly victims, have succeeded in creating in the United States the most dangerous thing that we've encountered in our lifetime, which is an underclass that doesn't seem to be going anywhere." The Reverend Jesse Jackson joins us now on the line from Washington, D.C. He's founder of Rainbow Push Coalition, a progressive organization fighting for social change. Welcome to Democracy Now, Reverend Jackson.
Good morning. How are you today?
It's good to have you with us. Your response to Tony Snow?
You know, I'm reluctant to dignify it, except there is an attempt to make the quest for racial justice illegitimate, an attempt to make gender equality illegitimate, an attempt to make a call for peace unpatriotic. That's a kind of a consistent right-wing line. The fact is that people of color were locked out of opportunity by law and must be protected by law. And under this administration, that law is not being enforced. For example, we were denied the right to vote by law for 346 years until 1965. The law in 1965 was an 1870 law passed that was not honored by the states, and the federal government had to intervene. What's relevant today about that is in Louisiana today, that law has been suspended again. So Iraqi Americans can vote by satellite from America to Baghdad and Fallujah. But New Orleanians cannot vote by satellite from New York or from Memphis to New Orleans. So we're fighting for a democracy in Iraq we do not honor at home. And who are the victims of that? For the most part, people of color. So that's not something I'm creating. That is government policy.
Reverend Jackson, you are also going to be here in New York this weekend for the major protest that is going to be taking place against war. Can you talk about the plans?
You know, Amy, I was in London before the war started saying there was no basis for the war, and 2 million people marched that day in London, but also around the world, saying the UN inspectors had not been given a fair chance, and there was no evidence at that point of weapons of mass destruction, imminent threat, Al-Qaeda connection. We were right then when our friend and sister led the drive in New York just before the Republican convention, Sister Lester Kagan. It was the time then for Democratic leadership to join the demonstration. They did not, trying to play coy. But now it seems that it is even more obvious we need to march to end a war based upon lies and spies. We've lost money and lives and honor. I urge all Americans who care about another course to meet us in New York on Saturday to march to end the war in Iraq.
We're also joined here in the studio as we talk about mass demonstrations that are scheduled all over by Hani Khalil, who is with United for Peace and Justice, organizer and coordinator. Can you talk about the specific plans for New York and for the various places that people will be protesting this weekend?
Sure. Well, we're going to have what we expect to be a massive march for peace, justice, and democracy here in New York City tomorrow. People are coming from all across the country. We've got buses coming from as far away as Wisconsin, Detroit, Chicago. There are peace trains being organized from Connecticut and Jersey and New York State. 1,000 people coming on a peace train from New Haven. Labor is going to have what we expect to be the largest labor anti-war contingent probably in history on Saturday. So we're very excited about what we think is going to be a powerful demonstration to call for an end to the Iraq war, but also a no war whatsoever on Iran and new priorities here at home. We're going to be meeting at 12 o'clock, marching at 12 o'clock from just north of Union Square down Broadway, where we'll proceed to Foley Square and have what will be a dynamic peace and justice grassroots action festival, where there'll be more than 19 themed tents and 100 organizations that are going to offer information and opportunities for people to plug into action to end this war in Iraq.
Mm. Reverend Jackson, you've been dealing with New Orleans. You're dealing with the war. You also have made an offer to a young woman in North Carolina, in Durham, to help her out with her education because of her allegations of rape at Duke University. And I was wondering if you could talk about, the connections between violence.
Well, you know, the circumstances surrounding the Duke case are still being revealed by the prosecutor. What I do know is I have compassion on the young woman. And if her argument is that she tries to pay her way through school and sustain her two children that she had to strip and to bear her body as a way of making a living, let's relieve her of that burden. While there were those who would say don't abort, adopt, I would say, you know, don't strip scholarship. Let's get her a scholarship and a job that she may be able to work her way out of the hole without going deeper into it. It is unfortunate that we are so tolerant of violence against women, and that becomes another reason, I think, to stand with her until we find out what's happening.
And finally, talking about Louisiana, talking about New Orleans, there is the vote coming up again, the mayoral runoff, but there isn't satellite voting outside of Louisiana. Your comments on where the situation now stands in New Orleans.
What is sad about that, Amy, is that 2/3 of the citizens in 47 states around the country, The fact is that unused military bases like English Air Force Base in Alexandria and Algiers Base, Bill Chase Base, those citizens never had the option to move to those unused bases closer to home or unused state parks, for example. Many of them were in exile, could be living close enough to home to be actually living in temporary housing and working at the same time. Now they're strung out around the country. On last Saturday for the election, thousands came back by bus and some by plane. And while that looks dramatic, why should they have to done that in the first place? If you're a first-time voter, you must by state law show up and vote in person. What an expense just to vote. If you have voted before, you must have two witnesses on authorized affidavit, but you must send for the ballot. They send it back to you. You send it back to Baton Rouge, and then they take it to New Orleans. That is an onerous process upon the basic voter. Why can't those New Orleans who are in exile have the opportunity to vote where they are living now temporarily? The fact is, the Department of Justice abdicated its responsibility to uphold the standard of Voting Rights Act, Section 2, where you cannot dilute minorities, or Section 5, there must be preclearance before you move precincts. Rather than the Department of Justice upholding that standard, since they're anti-Voting Rights Act, they threw it to the state. And now states' rights, for the first time since 1965, are determining the basis of voting. And so it is a sense of injustice that those who are the most able and the most mobile are there to vote and play golf and open their businesses back up for tourism. The least able are strung out around the country. It just seems that it violates the Voting Rights Act in such a profound way that for us to be fighting for democracy at the billion dollars a day, killing and getting killed in Iraq, and will not afford it in New Orleans, is just, again, another reason why we got to march in big numbers this coming Saturday in New York.
Ani Khalil, last comment.
Well, I think if there's anything we've learned from the massive immigrant rights mobilizations over the last few weeks, it's that mass marches can make a difference in shaping the debate in the media and what's going on in Congress. So it's vital that folks come out to this march tomorrow, Saturday, April 29th, to Midtown Manhattan, and join us in the streets. There's an exciting coalition of groups that's come together, including Reverend Jackson's Rainbow Push, the National Organization for Women, Friends of the Earth, all working with United for Peace and Justice to make this the most positive and powerful opposition to the war in Iraq and the entire Bush agenda. For more information, people should go to april29.org. That's april29.org or unitedforpeace.org.
I want to thank you for being with us, Ani Khalil, and Reverend Jesse Jackson for speaking to us. He'll be in New York this weekend. When we come back from break, we'll go to Los Angeles about preparations for the immigrants' rights protests on Monday. And we'll also talk about the protest on Sunday in Washington against genocide in Sudan. Stay with us. Marching Across the Land by Voices of East Harlem here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, immigrant rights groups have called for a nationwide general immigrant strike. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of immigrants are expected to stage a work strike and take part in a one-day economic boycott to protest anti-immigrant legislation being considered by Congress. We are going now to Los Angeles to speak with Nativo Lopez, the national president president of the Mexican-American Political Association, national director of Hermandad Mexicana Latino America. He joins us in the studio in Irvine. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the plans for Monday?
Sure. Monday is the day without immigrants. We're going to rescue May Day for immigrant workers, for all workers in America. Cities throughout the country will be demonstrating against H.R. 4437, the Sensenbrenner bill, the nastiest legislation that we've seen in Congress since the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which actually made it a crime to aid and abet a fugitive slave seeking his freedom. That's the Sensenbrenner bill is the modern version of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. We're also asking for full and unconditional amnesty for all the undocumented currently in the United States. We're opposed to any guest worker programs or also employer sanctions that seek to punish and sanction with a crime employers that hire individuals that don't have immigration status. This is a continuing mass mobilization that we've seen in March and April and now culminating in May to impose the voice of the immigrant on the national immigrant debate or immigration debate. And assure that the options that the immigrants are putting forth are the predominant options and not those being proposed by the hierarchies, the Democratic Party or other hierarchies that would seek a compromise, not in the interest of the immigrant communities.
Why don't we talk about that, the parties? What the Republicans have proposed and what the Democrats, you feel, are settling for?
Well, the Democrats are settling for embodied in legislation called the McCain-Kennedy Act, which would codify guest worker programs in our country on a national level, essentially creating a second-tier working class of immigrant workers, holding out the prospect that they would eventually be legalized, at least under that plan. And we don't think that that is appropriate unless these workers are absolutely protected by federal labor law, state wage and our standards, and are secured the right to organize into the union. In addition to that, we believe that the stratified legalization program proposed under the McCain-Kennedy is something that's not in the interest of the immigrant community. It would essentially take a person who already has an average of 5 years in the United States working in undocumented status an additional 5 to 10 years to obtain legal status. And lastly, the proposal includes employer sanctions more onerous than current law, supposedly as a disincentive for employers to hire individuals that don't have documents. But the historical practice with employer sanctions has been patterns of discrimination against individuals that are foreign appearing or using a language other than English. The onus is really on the worker under employer sanctions, so we believe that it's not something that's in the interest of the immigrant community.
How do you feel about what the minority leader, Harry Reid, has done? He did not join in the McCain-Kennedy compromise.
Well, in addition to that, he hasn't really put forward a program broader than the McCain-Kennedy. We almost saw a compromise close prior to the Easter recess, a Senate version that had many aspects of the Sensenbrenner bill on the Senate side. We're the position that better no bill this year than a bad bill. The compromise that they could reach in the Senate, we don't believe would stand favorable to immigrants in a conference committee going against a exclusively enforcement measures proposed by the Sensenbrenner bill. So we don't really see much good coming out of a compromise in the Senate and the House.
Nativa Lopez is national president of the Mexican American Political Association. What about the question about boycott or not? The issue protest, yes, but there is some controversy over whether boycott is the most effective approach. Your stand on that?
We have nothing on the table. We haven't won anything. The mega marches that have occurred in March and April, an estimated 5 and 6 million people have marched throughout the country. We stalled the train that was already leaving the station. to approve the Sensenbrenner bill and some compromise version in the Senate, but there's nothing on the table for immigrants currently. The last specter of compromise that occurred in the Senate, called the Hagel-Martinez bill, for example, created a caste legalization system that was repudiated by the immigrant community throughout the country. So there's really nothing on the table for immigrants. We want to make sure that the voice of the immigrant is the paramount voice in the current debate in Congress, and we believe that we need to kick it up a notch. Boycotts, civil disobedience of a nonviolent nature, essentially what we're talking about, people applying a Gandhian principle of non-cooperation. The immigrant friends and family will essentially say, I will not cooperate with a system that abuses me today by offering my labor. I will withhold my labor today. I will withhold my consumption today, and I will participate in marches again demanding the burial of H.R. 4437 and any similar type of legislation, and a demand for full, immediate, unconditional amnesty for all immigrant workers.
Where do you expect these protests to take place on Monday?
We will see the restoration of May Day in Chicago, for example. It's estimated that 1 million people will march in Chicago. Chicago will shut down on May Day. Throughout California, there will be 20 marches in the major cities. Again, millions of people will participate in that action. In the states of Oregon, Washington State, Texas, Arizona, Utah, New York City, Washington, D.C. itself, notwithstanding counsel from existing national immigration organizations or Hispanic organizations, the people on the ground, the working people, this movement has been built from the ground. The worker on the ground has internalized this message of withholding his labor on May Day. This is what we're going to observe on May Day. The weight of the contribution of the immigrant and his presence and her presence in the economy will be felt on May Day by observing their absence.
Nativa Lopez, I want to thank you for being with us from Irvine, California, national president of the Mexican-American Political Association.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Thank you for joining us. As we turn now to Washington, D.C., we're joined by Joe Madison. He's president of the Sudan Campaign, serve as MC on Sunday for another major protest that will be taking place, the Rally to Stop Genocide in Sudan. He's also the host of the radio show The Black Eagle. He joins us on the line from his radio studio in Maryland. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joe Madison.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me again. I really appreciate that.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about the protest that you're going to be a part of on Sunday.
It's actually a rally. It's a wake-up call. Here's what the mission is. Several years ago when this whole thing started, when we first started talking about it, long before anyone was even knew where Darfur was or southern Sudan, the President of the United States had a briefing on Rwanda, and in the pages, in the margins of the briefing pages, he wrote, "Not on my watch." Well, guess what? It has happened on his watch. Darfur is the 21st century's first genocide. And so Sunday, individual members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, because they do have a unison agreement, a resolution saying that it is genocide. The administration has declared it is genocide. The problem is that we're all disappointed that they really haven't done enough to stop the genocide. So the purpose of the rally is to bring students together, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, to say, not on my watch. We will stop this genocide. The UN has a responsibility. NATO may have a responsibility. We all have a responsibility.
And specifically, you're calling for what for Congress to do for people today?
Well, first of all, the survivors of the genocide have to be protected from this genocide so that some 2 million of them can leave various parts of Chad. Many have now gone into southern Sudan. Matter of fact, I'll be leaving Monday for a 10-day fact-finding mission to southern Sudan and parts of Darfur, hopefully, even though people aren't allowed in. But we'll be going into those regions of Sudan because now Darfurians are filtering with their families down into southern Sudan, which was torn up by a war 20 years ago. There has to be justice for those who, in fact, who were involved in the crime of genocide. And there has to also, we have to also hold China and Russia accountable because they have continually blocked efforts to try and end this genocide. China imports, I think Sudanese oil is like the seventh largest import that China has, and Russia is currently selling MiGs and other weapons to Sudan. And finally, there must be a special envoy, someone with a status that can go in and negotiate a peace for this conflict.
Joe Madison, we just have 30 seconds. The UN is saying today it'll cut food rations for more than 6 million people in Sudan, half of them in Darfur, due to a severe lack of funds.
This is absolutely amazing, absolutely crazy. And I'm telling you, it is racist in nature. It is sad because if I came on your show today and told you that there were 2 million people starving to death as we speak right now, and that there are over 400,000 who are dead and counting, and this was happening in western Germany or the southern part of France, there would not be this type of reaction from the UN or any other governmental body.
Well, Joe Madison, I want to thank you very much for being with us, president of the Sudan campaign. He will serve as MC for the rally to stop genocide in Sudan this Sunday. I want to thank you for joining us. And now you can go back to your radio show as we turn now to the end of our program, a story out of New York right here. Thursday, 18 peace activists were acquitted on charges of blocking the entrance to a military recruitment center in Times Square. The case gained national attention because the 18 people on trial were all grandmothers, part of the raging grannies. The grannies face up to 15 days in jail for their protest if convicted. Shortly after their acquittal, Democracy Now! Caught up with 91-year-old Marie Runyon outside Manhattan Criminal Court.
In October, we decided that it was time to take this action, try to go over there and get rid of some of the young people were there. So we've been yelling and carrying on and meeting and et cetera ever since. And for the last 6 or 8 days, we have been in court. And today, the court decided that Bush is wrong and that we are right. The 18 grandmothers did the right thing. So we'll keep on doing it and hoping that other people will do the same thing. I mean, there's no problem. You go out and you declare that the war is wrong and you take whatever action you decide on. It's kind of nice to get a little legal help so that you know that you're not breaking any terrible laws. You can't go around breaking windows and stuff like that. But you can certainly use your First Amendment rights and your voices, and you're allowed not only to stand but to sit down, which is what we learned about that that recruitment site. We were allowed to sit down there. I think the judge even specified that as a part of the decision anyway. So carry on. Don't let nobody turn you around. You gotta keep on keeping on.
Marie Runyon, she's 91, one of the 18 grandmothers who was acquitted yesterday in Manhattan for protesting war. And that does it for today's program. For a copy of the show, you can go to democracynow.org and for all the links to the organizations we've talked to. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Frank Lopez and Jenny Hutes. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, as well as Nick Marsilio. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin and Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!